Welcome to Arts ID on KRCB Radio, our showcase on Sonoma County arts and artists in all forms and flavors. I'm your host, Robin Pressman. This time, Arts ID focuses on storytelling from a very personal perspective. Tonight, three playwrights tell their own stories in very different ways. We'll hear from playwright Rebecca Miller, the author of Fault Lines, actor and playwright David Templeton, whose play Pinky premieres next week in Sebastopol, and stand-up comedian and playwright Dave Picorni tells us about West Side Stories in Petaluma. That's all ahead on Arts ID on KRCB Radio. First up tonight, Susan Swartz talks with playwright Rebecca Miller about her play Fault Lines, which recently had its West Coast premiere at Main Stage West in Sebastopol. Miller grew up in Sonoma County, now is an actor and playwright in New York, and she was a grade school friend of Polly Klass. Fault Lines is her fictional story of the effort of survivors of a similar tragedy to deal with their long-held grief. Susan Swartz talks with Rebecca Miller about how you tell a story that is yours, but not necessarily yours to tell.
Rebecca, I'd like to talk a little bit about the creative process in terms of your writing Fault Lines. Obviously, it is a play of which the impetus, as you say, in the program was this tragedy of Polly Klass that our county, of course, was very much involved in. And you personally, as a young girl, knew Polly.
Yeah.
So you take your connection to a story, a tragic story, but a major story, and you combine it with some facts. So you've got your memories, you've got the case.
Yeah.
And then you turn it into something, a third being, a third creature, really. Is that how it worked for you?
Well, first of all, I don't know why I always feel like I need to make it clear. I didn't know her at the time this happened. We had been friends when in elementary school, and she had gone on and changed schools, and I had lost track of her, like you do. You don't hold on to friendships when you're that young. And the next time I heard about her, it was on the news. So we were friends at Hidden Valley Elementary in Santa Rosa before she moved to Petaluma. So it was just this thing that, I guess the best way to describe it is it's like this thing I could never really integrate into my overall understanding of the world. It was, obviously, I think even for people who had never met her, it was completely terrifying. And just to feel like somebody I had known and really, really liked, that something so, unfair is like the smallest possible word you could use for it. But something so horrific could befall her, and it's due to nothing, no fault of her own or her parents, or it's just random.
And unexplainable and impossible to rationalize and impossible to say, but that wouldn't happen to me.
And how can you accept living in a world where something like this can just happen?
So this sat with you.
Yeah.
You lived with this. Like one of your characters talks about it being a tumor.
Yeah.
Was that how it was in a way
for you? I think so. I mean, and these characters obviously were much closer to it than I was, and I'm trying to respect the fact that there are people who are this close as these characters are, and which I am not.
Right.
But yeah, it was something that if I were to really take this into my understanding of the world, that makes the world into an unacceptable place. So it was something that would just like bubble up from time to time. And I would even find myself thinking like thinking about my friend Polly, who had been at my birthday party and you know, had given me a yo-yo and be like, what is she doing now? What college is she at? Mm-hmm. And it would be like the split second before I'd realize, no, she's Polly.
She's the one. Oh,
because I almost feel like there became, you know, Polly became an icon of mm-hmm. something. And it was of something outside of who she was. I'm sure as I knew her, and I'm sure as her, well, I imagine outside of how her family and friends knew her at the time.
And that was part of this. This is your imagining. This is you kind of creating how three girls who were there at this slumber party, how they have grown up to be. You don't know them.
I don't know them.
You
and in fact, I did not research them. And you know, the facts are that there were two people who witnessed this thing, and I wish for them to be left alone.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. And so you've never met them.
No, and none of these characters are based on them. And you know, I'm sure, I hope that they are in a better, happier place actually than these characters happen to be. These characters are just sort of my own reflections of my own thinking about what happened. And I'm also somebody who didn't take an active role in healing whatever damage was done mm-hmm. by this. And I feel like most of us didn't because we weren't so close to it. And there's something about shared trauma. Like, I live in New York City now. And, you know, people who were around during September 11th, almost nobody has sought counseling except for people who lost somebody
directly
or who were there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is so much stored up trauma and pain. And I feel like it's sort of an analogous situation here.
Mm-hmm.
That people did have these incredibly strong reactions to what happened. But at least from my perspective, is I never felt like this is my story, this is my pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then this play just sort of bubbled out.
You have one of the characters saying, if I hadn't been there, it would have been a different kind of grief, wondering if I could have stopped it instead of knowing it was out of my control. So is that kind of where you are in that personal connection to the tragedy? I mean, I think that's how the audience feels.
Yeah.
We weren't there, but we imagined what we would have done or thought or the fear and the horror of it all.
I think it's easy to imagine having been there. I mean, there wasn't the circumstances of we were not in touch. So there wasn't really any chance of me having been at that particular party. And I remember the discussions at school. People were talking about it constantly. You know, what would you have done? You know, and the truth is...
You mean among your friends at school?
Yeah.
Did teachers talk about it?
Well, the teachers would sit us down and say, you guys can talk now.
Okay.
I mean, we stopped having health class for a couple of weeks because people just needed to vent. And, you know, bunches of us had gone to elementary school with her. I was at Santa Rosa Junior High at the time. And even for people who hadn't, it was on the tip of everybody's tongue. And I remember a girl... I remember it so clearly, it was in my math class, said, we have to stop talking about her because she won't be able to rest.
Oh.
And it's still, I still think of it, you know, mm-hmm. and it's been a scary idea of like, what if all this talking about her has mm-hmm. kept her from that?
Whoa, that's
yeah.
a good one.
Well, and then that begs a question of what is the value of bringing a play?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, the play is about a character named Nina. I mean, it's about her three friends who are mm-hmm. all fictional, and they're mourning this girl.
Was this the first time creatively you had drawn on that experience?
Oh, yeah. It was something that I tried to actively avoid thinking about. Also for this issue of ownership, I didn't feel like it was my issue.
And well, one of your characters says it is not your story.
Yeah, it doesn't belong to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some validity to that, but at the same time, there is this community of people who experience this thing that we're all still. I mean, the responses when we have performed it, the responses during the talkbacks, people are saying, "This is this thing that's never healed for me." So, and these are people who didn't know her, but just you know had children or were children or just heard about it. People are saying that it's actually been a helpful thing to sort of remember what this was like in order to confront it and start healing it.
You've heard that in the talkbacks
yeah.
here in Sonoma County.
Several times, yeah. And
so people yeah. who weren't connected,
yeah.
who would stand up and did they thank you?
Yeah, it's been really intense.
Whoa.
On Friday night, I went to see the show for the first time, and a woman introduced me to her son. I'm going to get emotional just talking about it, who was born the day they found her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And
Whoa.
He was this 18-year-old man standing
Whoa.
Here. So he was this embodiment of all this time that had passed. And she'd said, you know, you keep the newspaper, the front page of the newspaper from the day your child is
of
born.
Course.
And I've never been able to show it to him. So it's just been incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
to be back here with it. It just means something different here than it could in New York. And, you know, New York audiences felt strongly about it, too, mm-hmm. because while it's about something specific and a specific place, it's also about the end of childhood. It's also about those things, the unexplainable things that happen in life in everyone's hometown.
Mm-hmm. The media plays an important part in this play. Was that something you wanted to talk specifically about in the play, that why do all these news people always have to come around? And I would have to say, as a news reporter, of course you have to come around. Something's happened right. in your town. You're not going to let it go. But do you feel like there's a line that is crossed at some point?
Yeah, I remember very specifically after they found her, there was a private moment of grief between her mother and her sister that ended up on camera. And I remember seeing it and just feeling like, oh, God, this is not something I should be a part of. I shouldn't be seeing this right now. And I was 12, you know, and it was such a strong impulse that this is wrong. And at the same time, there is this community's right to know. And as I've been writing this play, it took me a really long time to write it. Part of the reason was that, you know, how much of this is an act of exploitation?
How much is the play?
Of writing it, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, I felt like all I can do is try to tell a story like this one, right? Because I'm not qualified to tell Polly's story. And it's really not even the story about the girl who gets kidnapped. It's a story about her friends trying to get through it. Mm-hmm. And how do you live with something like this mm-hmm. in your life? But it's always been this kind of issue of like, you know, I don't need to do anything that reminds the family that this happened to them. And that's something, honestly, I'm still struggling with.
As a member of the media, I remember, though, we've been so involved at the Press Democrat in all of these grisly murders. And then every time there's an anniversary of one of these grisly things, then the media comes back.
Yeah.
So you're right to remind people that there is this exploitation thing that happens. Foundations, every agency, every fundraiser, how much of that is an exploitation?
Well, and I thought a lot about, you know, what does it mean to build your life on something terrible that's happened and to create a life in activism in response to it? And I thought a lot about actually John Walsh,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what does it mean that his grief for his son has turned into this movement, really. But then I think about, you know, it's his living also.
Mm-hmm.
But then really, it's easy to sort of get judgy about people in these positions. And the truth is, if somebody's been through something like this, like what John Walsh went through, or any member of Polly's family, they have a right to react however they can to get through the day.
Exactly, yeah.
And we don't have the right to judge them for that.
Mm-hmm.
So despite the fact that my characters do some judging, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that everybody got enough of an opportunity to defend themselves and in the play, and that it doesn't come across as a judgment on my part.
And it's horrible that we have to use another person's tragedy to tell these stories, but that's what we do when we're as writers. We know that we write about what we know. And I did read an interview with you that you said that your husband said, "If you don't write this, I'm writing."
Yeah, he did. This had just come up somehow several years into our relationship, that the fact that this thing had happened in my hometown and that I had known her as a kid, and he was sort of blown away by it. And it just sort of kept bubbling up. Once, you know, it was one of those things that, like, you push it away, you don't want to deal with it. My husband finally said, you know, this is your play. And I was being a real wimp because I was talking about it, but I wasn't actively writing it. And he finally, he threatened me. He was like, you know, I'm going to sit down at my computer now and start outlining if you're not going to sit down and write this now. And he went to his computer and started typing. And I went, and I picked up my laptop and I stormed into the next room and started working.
Good husband.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a little bit about the humor.
Oh.
A lot of people laughing in
yeah.
the audience.
Thank God. I didn't think that was going to happen in Sonoma County at all.
But you knew the lines were in there
yes.
to hopefully draw some laughter.
And I tried to keep it all the way through. You know, we knew in New York, if our audience was not laughing in that first scene, we were sunk. Because from there, things get really heavy.
So you had, that's why we have a lot of the California wine country stuff in there.
Some pokes at the hippie culture behind this place.
I love that the spent hens.
Oh my gosh. Actually, I think spent hens is going to be a play of its own. I've been thinking about it for a long time. About the women who organize around these hens.
Did you make up the spent hens?
No, you know what? I read the Press Democrat for inspiration.
Oh, right.
You just never know. And it's the back page of the newspaper where you get the wacko stories. I also find a lot of sort of violence is happening here.
And I remember Tom Wolfe millions of years ago saying, you know, if you can't get an inspiration for a novel out of reading, you know, the local paper, then you have no imagination whatsoever. It was important as an audience member to have that humor there. And as a writer, was that important to have a way that the audience could relax a little?
Yeah.
Or else we were all going to just have breakdowns.
Yeah. Also, I think people tend to they don't lose their sense of humor because they're dealing with tragedy. And a lot of people use it as a coping mechanism. If this play gets, I actually have a note. I don't know if you read a copy with one of the playwright's notes at the beginning, but I say, you know, hey, actors, don't lean in on the drama of this play because the drama is there. This was something we really found through trial and error when my company produced it the first time. Actors are very proud of their ability to have painful emotions, and it's something that we are trained to do, and we, you know, it's like we're like the Marines of the soul. We want to just like, you know, be airdropped into despair and get there right away. And this play does not work that way. It will fall. It's like a souffle, you know. It'll fall in on itself. If you start with despair in that first scene, there's nowhere to go. And obviously, and I think they did a really good job of doing this here. There's so much intense emotion boiling underneath from the beginning.
Yes, and the woman, Bethany, the woman with the children and all that, and she's a wreck. Yeah. She's just such a wreck. And when finally the one character says, stop it, because we're all thinking that too, and people laugh. But from there on, there is humor. And my husband said, again, when we left, I said, I'm so thankful there were things to laugh at in this play. And he said, but I felt guilty laughing. I worried about it.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to be laughing?
I was feeling like, oh my gosh, no one in Sonoma County, people are going to come in knowing what this is about. The people in New York thought they were seeing a comedy for the first, you know, for the first scene. And really, what I tried to mine in that first scene is the nervous energy of people who don't know what they're walking into and are absolutely terrified. And that can be made funny. And I think that the Main Stage West production does an excellent job of mining that.
And I, again, going back to like a lot of the wine country barbs and some of the earthquake stuff. Do you have a fear of earthquakes? Is that why you're living in New York?
I know. I'm like, we have our own disasters, natural and otherwise, to deal with in New York. But, There's this awareness that it could happen at any time, and I feel like that is something that's very distinct to this place. Granted, when people ask me about, you know, fearing terrorist attacks in New York, I tell them it's totally analogous to this idea of earthquakes. Mm-hmm. You know something's going to get through at some point, and all you can do is just be as ready as possible. But really, there is no bracing yourself for it because you don't know what's coming. I mean, it's heaven here, and especially having lived somewhere else and coming back to visit now as a more of an adult. I look at these hills that I feel like are imprinted in me in some way, and it's so beautiful, and the weather is so mild, and the people are so proudly liberal and open-minded.
right.
Yes, at least in theory. And yet, this whole thing could literally crumble into dust at any moment, and it's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But the truth is, it's human nature to turn a blind eye to the difficult and scary possibilities. You just can't live in full awareness all the time without going insane.
One more thing. Was it harder emotionally for you writing the play or acting in it?
This whole thing, it was not a fun play for me to write. Even, you know, the funny parts, it was like, oh, good, something came out. Thank goodness, you know. I can avoid jumping off a building today. But it was so difficult to make myself go into my room and live, think about all these memories that I've been actively repressing for years. The hardest part of everything has been watching it. I mean, it's been brilliant. The productions are brilliant, and I've been really pleased with them. But coming to see it here, where it has real ramifications, where there are people who experienced it in a way much closer than I did. In New York, I could know that maybe with one or two exceptions, I probably had the closest relationship to the events that led me to write the play. But here, that's just nowhere near the case. There are family members, there are friends, there are people who were really impacted. So I've sort of been forced to ask myself again, like, what right do I have? What right do I have? What is the good of this? And to walk into it, you know, not being sure, honestly, you know, having to sort of question what my intentions are. And again, that has been terrifying, to see a family member who I recognize on site, you know, in the audience, and say, you know, why is this person putting themselves through this? And I hope not to contribute to this, to his pain, which is something beyond imagining. And it's something that the imagining of this pain prompted me to write the play. And then the idea of contributing to it is just heinous. So it's been terrifying, but ultimately really gratifying, because people feel like this has been a part of their healing process.
Susan Swartz talking with playwright Rebecca Miller about her play Fault Lines. It ran just recently at Main Stage West Theater in Sebastopol. It's Arts ID on KRCB Radio. I'm your host, Robin Pressman. Coming up next, we change gears a little bit and talk about a very personal story, First Love, from David Templeton. Arts ID is very fond of Pinky. David Templeton's story of his pursuit of his first love first took shape as a radio story on the very first episode of Arts ID a couple of years ago. Since then, he's written the story as a two-person play, which opens Friday, March 9th at Main Stage West in Sebastopol. But here's the original story as it first ran 2 years ago on Arts ID.
As a teenager in the 70s, I used to read a lot, lots of fantasy. You know, big epic adventures, stuff with swords in it. At the movies, I was a sucker for the Disney animated fairy tales. Dragons, magic mirrors, damsels in distress. In all those stories, though, it was never the handsome, good-looking heroes or the blank-faced princes that I identified with. Now, I always felt the most kinship with the tragic second-string characters, the trolls, the woodsmen, the flying monkeys, or maybe the cursed princes, like in Beauty and the Beast. You know, otherwise decent guys, now doomed to become monsters or frogs or hedgehogs, I identified with them. But those dashing dudes in tights, the knights in shining armor, the Prince Charmings, I hated those guys. Still, for a few months there, I had this secret. Hidden in a box in my room was a custom-made Prince Charming outfit. A pretty decent replica of the one worn by the prince in Disney's Sleeping Beauty. The cape, the boots, and, yeah, the tights. Only a handful of my friends knew about it. So, what was the deal with that suit? And why had I also recently started taking horse riding lessons? What was the motivation behind all of this? Her name was Pinky. We lived in the same Los Angeles suburb. We went to different high schools, but we attended the same church. I was 15 when I first met her. She was 14. I was smitten, just totally smitten, from the first moment I saw her. That first time in 1975 was at a Bible study. Pinky had long brown hair. She had freckles. She was gorgeous. I don't know when exactly I first learned about Prince Charming. That's what Pinky called the future love of her life, Prince Charming, PC for short. See, Pinky had this list, her PC list, a series of attributes that her own personal Prince Charming would have.
The way I remember it, there were 10 things on that list. No one except Pinky knew what all those things were. Now, by then, everyone knew, because I was pretty obvious, that I wanted to be Pinky's Prince Charming. I'd have done anything, changed anything about me to make myself Prince Charming. For years, I only hinted to Pinky about my feelings. When I finally did make those feelings known, she was a little taken aback. I mean, we'd always been just friends. To make her position completely clear, she let me know that on her PC scale, I was a 7. Just a 7. But 7? Hey, it could be worse, right? If I was a 7, I only had 3 to go. I straight out asked her if there was any way that I could work my way higher up that list to somehow become a 10. What she said was, hey, it never hurts to try. What specifically can I do? I wanted to know. Well, sweep me off my feet, she suggested. How do I do that? If you're Prince Charming, Pinky said, you'll figure it out. So how does a nerdy 17-year-old sweep a girl off her feet? If you're me, if you're a Tolkien fan, you start writing her poems in Elvish. You recruit some kids from your church to dress up like dwarves and hobbits with little fake beards and hats and get them to deliver roses to the girl's front door. You sneak into her front yard and fill it with Christmas trees. I did all that and a lot more. The more elaborate my schemes became, the more of my friends I pulled into my sweeping Pinky off her feet plan. One of my more down-to-earth co-schemers was Laura, who I'd known since the 9th grade.
I do remember very well the almost single-minded quest from David to get to Pinky. And I remember hearing all Pinky all the time, but she always seemed to engage David. And once it was kind of more one-sided, and I think David, being a wildly creative guy, just followed his heart, and his heart was clearly with Pinky. Well, I remember that there was a list, but I never saw the list. But I remember there was the PC or Prince Charming list, and it may have been a mental list. There were some physical attributes like eye color, height. I'm trying to think if there was an ability to play a musical instrument. Oh, maybe he had to be a good singer. He had to be maybe very organized and spotlessly clean.
I remember that there was a measurement, a metric of some sort that Pinky had in mind, and a metric that she used to decide who should be the man that she was with for the rest of time.
This is Jake. Jake would become one of my primary collaborators in my attempts to transform myself into Pinky's PC.
I remember that metric was either on a scale of 1 to 10 or 10 items. I do remember that it required a perfect score. That is, whoever was going to be the man that she was with would have to hit 10.
One night, Pinky called me to tell me that I had officially risen from 7 to 8 on the PC scale. This was a big moment for me. I mean, I made it to 8. I had just 2 more to go.
I don't remember a list. However, I did keep a journal. I did write down my heart from the time I was 14 all through high school and through college. And so I probably did have a list. I don't remember the list.
That's Pinky herself, who I should say I haven't seen face-to-face for over 25 years. Did she actually say she doesn't remember the list?
I'm sure I could remember a few of the things that were on it, but it's just funny to think about a list. How presumptuous. Oh, I'm sure that I wanted somebody who was tall and good-looking and... probably on the list would have been somebody who could play a musical instrument.
I definitely remember that there were blue eyes on her list.
Blue eyes could have been on the list. I don't know. I probably was looking for somebody with blue eyes.
For the record, I have blue eyes. But back to Pinky.
Well, you know, I suppose I set myself up for disappointments, or maybe even set other people up for disappointments. But I guess it gets back down to this. I'm a Christian. I have faith in God. I pray. And from an early age, I prayed and prayed and prayed for the man who would be my husband someday. Well, I knew that it would come about. Didn't know when, didn't know how. But I also knew that when it came about, I would know.
In most of the fantasy stories I read, the princess, at some point, is kidnapped by bad guys and then rescued by the good guy. Then, and only then, she sees him for what he really is. And they all live happily ever after. But there has to be a rescue first. During a series of feverish, late-night, caffeine-boosted brainstorming sessions with Jake and Laura and others, lightning finally struck. I knew how I could sweep Pinky off her feet. I'd have her kidnapped, and then I'd rescue her. The plan took me weeks to work out and months to set in place. There were two major elements. First came the treasure hunt. Using ideas and character names from The Lord of the Rings and The Narnia Chronicles, I planted clues all over town. Clues Pinky would use to gradually find her way to a spectacular treasure, in this case, a big stuffed lion. I took my task very seriously. I snuck a library book, Volume 1 of The Complete Writings of Abraham Lincoln, into the restroom where I pasted a clue behind a replica version of the book's inside cover. I secretly sunk a clue in a fancy Japanese restaurant's big koi pond. At one point, I even disguised myself as a shopping mall custodian to bury a clue in plain sight amidst the shrubs and palm trees of the mall's well-manicured parking lot. The second part of the scheme was the most important. It required the involvement of dozens of people: makeup artists, costumers, fight choreographers, medieval weapon specialists. In short, Pinky would be abducted. There'd be a sword fight. I would rescue her. And she would see at last that I was, you know, Prince Charming.
There was a clue that showed up probably at my door, but every clue was coded or riddled, or in some way you had to solve a puzzle before you could get the clue, and then once you got the clue, you had to find where the clue led you. I do remember that one of the clues was where a wooded lake meets a fiery stone. There was an intersection in my town, just fitting the description of the wooded lake meeting the fiery stone, and I had to go in front of a thrifty drug and discount store. I had to stand in front of it and face south and pace 200 paces and then dig in the middle of this median, in the middle of a parking lot, in the middle of a shopping center. I had to dig down 2 feet to get the next clue. And so I did find the spot, and I did dig it up. And it was a little wooden chest, and inside was the next clue. It led me to a Catholic church, where I had to count the number of rows from the back of the church. And then I had to reach under the pew and get the next clue, which was taped to the underside of the pew in this Catholic church. I mean, it was so wonderful because it stretched my imagination and it stretched my ability, and it made me appreciate the creativity behind the clue giver. But it didn't stop there. The next day, I think the next day was the 4th of July, and on this day I was kidnapped by orcs who were, you know, costumed bad guys, ruffians. I was kidnapped and blindfolded and taken in the back of a pickup truck. Being blindfolded, I was led down a series of brick steps to another bridge and a beautiful waterfall, and there were costumed heroes, including Aragorn, who was David, of course, protecting me from the orcs. There was a sword fight. are you getting all this?
So here's how it went. As Pinky and the kidnapper started to cross, I leaped onto the bridge. "Let the princess go or accept the consequences," I said. Jake, laughing evilly, said, "Remove the lady's blindfold so she can watch her rescuer die." I wrote the script. So then, using these really cool fight moves that we'd practiced for weeks, I fought and killed James and then Jake. The last was Jeff. We battled fiercely, clanging and clashing our swords, and then at one point, I noticed my hand was dripping blood. Holy, what? Jeff had somehow actually slashed me. So I killed him. And as I stood above the waterfall, Jeff slowly rolled down the hill and back onto the bridge where Pinky was still standing. So when we asked her if she realized that all this, the treasure hunt, the sword fight, me rescuing her during which I was actually wounded, I still have the scar. When asked if she realized at that time that this was me trying to sweep her off her feet, here's what Pinky says.
Really? Well, literally, I was swept off my feet in that I was kidnapped, but I guess I never attributed it to a deeper love than a brotherly, sisterly love.
That is when I signed up for horse riding lessons. That is also when I ordered the Prince Charming suit. See, in fairy tales, a lot of times, there comes a point where the hero gets so totally beaten up by the three-headed monster or the one-eyed bridge keeper that he just really finally thinks, okay, time out. Methinks I'm being stupid. I wasn't there yet. I started planning out another adventure, another kidnapping. And this time, when I rescued Pinky, I would arrive on a horse, a white horse. I'd be dressed like Prince Charming. I'd ride up beside her, right in the thick of whatever danger I dreamed up for Pinky this time. I'd reach down, pull her up onto the horse, and gallop away. Clearly, I'd lost my mind. As it turns out, riding horses is not easy. After a couple of lessons, I realized that I was actually scared of horses. And it was pretty clear that horses hate me. By then, the suit had arrived. But I couldn't even bring myself to put it on. I'd left it in the box, waiting for the right time to make my big move. Then something happened that I could never have predicted. It was right before New Year's. Pinky and I had spent the night disposing of the 100 used Christmas trees that my friends and I had snagged from curbsides all over town. I'd left them standing in her front yard. I mean, I'd already done the roses thing. This time, I brought her a forest. So late that night, sitting in my truck, I confessed that I was on the verge of giving up on her, abandoning my quest. As we often did, we started talking about fairy tales. The fairy tales are kind of bogus, I suggested. I mean, in the fairy tales, the princess always sees the prince inside the monster. She said, "I always believed it was the kiss."
that changed the beast into the prince. The kiss comes first. I considered that, wondering what her point was. Well, she finally said, what are you waiting for? So I kissed her, and she kissed me back. In fact, she kissed me a little more aggressively than I was prepared for. I was both thrilled. I mean, I'm actually kissing Pinky, but I was also a little taken aback. I took her home, and as we said goodbye, I asked if I could kiss her again. She held out her hand, suggesting I kiss her hand, like a loyal subject suddenly returned to his place among the rabble. And like that, I knew it. I'd failed the test. Any plans I had for that stupid PC suit, they were scrapped in that moment. I wasn't Prince Charming. And I was never going to be. Our friendship changed after that. Eventually, I just kind of called it off. After years spent trying to rescue Pinky, I finally realized it was me who needed rescuing from her, or maybe from my fantasy of her. So I moved on. Eventually, I met another girl, and this one, she hated fairy tales.
David Templeton's story of First Love is now reborn as a two-person play, opening on Friday, March 9th at Main Stage West in Sebastopol. David plays David, and Liz Jaron plays Pinky. The play is directed by Sherry Lee Miller. You're listening to Arts ID, KRCB's showcase on Sonoma County arts and artists in all forms and flavors. Tonight's program focuses on storytelling from a personal perspective. Coming up next, stand-up comedian and playwright Dave Picorni wrote his first joke at the age of 17. From then on, he was hooked and he became a stand-up comedian, crisscrossing the country, performing in comedy clubs, until his daughter was born and he chose to be a stay-at-home dad. During that time, he vowed to write his own one-man show. And 15 years later, just last year, he performed based on a true story, his own story of life in the comedy world and beyond. Now Dave Picorni has a new project helping other people to tell their stories. He talked with John Moran of the Sonoma County Arts Council about his once-a-month showcase for personal stories, West Side Stories, in Petaluma.
So you talk about stories. Your main thrust, or one of your main thrusts now, is a program that you hold in Petaluma at the Pelican Gallery, courtesy of Linda Posson Ryder, and it's called West Side Stories. What is this based on?
Well, it's based on the Moth in New York, to be quite honest with you. Right. Juliet and I were in New York. We took a trip back there, and we said, well, we're back here, let's go check out the Moth. And the Moth is a storytelling group that started there, I think it was 1995, maybe, right, something like that. And it's called the Moth because of people sitting on a porch telling stories and the moth being attracted to the light. Yeah. Anyway, we went to the one in Brooklyn, which is the flagship there, and they have four different other ones. Three different other ones. They have Detroit, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and the Brooklyn one. And we were in Brooklyn and went, and there was 300 people standing out in front of this club to get in and see five-minute true stories live on stage. And not by professional storytellers, by everyday people, people who just dropped their name in the hat, which I happened to drop my name in the hat that night. I didn't get on. But the people that did get on, it was like the coolest thing. And 300 people just were riveted.
So how long ago was this?
This was about two years ago, I think.
And so obviously it impressed you, and you came back here. And did you just suddenly say, I've got to do this?
Well, what we did was we started, Juliet and I both looked up the Moth website, and they are still looking for other branches to have different venues across the country. So we found their mold and we follow their rules, and we still hope to become one of those branches at some point. But one of the things they said is you needed to record it, and Petaluma Community Access comes in and records our show every month, and they right. play it as programming. And, you know, so I can plug that too. We won 3 of their Viewer's Choice Awards last year, our first year out there, which was kind of cool. And then we send the DVDs back to the Moth, and we're hoping to become their fifth brand.
Tell me what the format is.
Format is I go on stage to open the show, and there's a theme for the night. For example, just this past month on February 8th, seeing it's Valentine's Day very close by, we did Love is Blind as the theme. Now, you okay. can tell a story about love. You could actually tell a story about being blind, or, you know, somebody that you love that is blind, or, you know, how you got blindsided by love, which is kind of what I talked about, blindsided by when my daughter was born, mm-hmm. that I no longer, you know, my whole life, my passion was doing stand-up, and then she was born, and I didn't want to go anymore.
So you introduced it with a story.
I come up with a story, and I tell okay. people the rules. They're 5-minute stories. At 5 minutes, I will tap a little bell, tell you you have 1 minute to wrap it up, and they will come up. They will do. I know they will sign up beforehand when they walk in, and we usually get over 10 people to sign up, and only 10 people are allowed to tell stories. So every once in a while, people do not get on, but their story can be remolded
so
for the next one.
How long does it last in total? About an hour and a half.
Hour and a half. We start at 7:30, second Wednesday every month, just about 9. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it goes a little bit long because sometimes I'm long-winded. But in between stories, I have people in the audience fill out little forms, completely anonymous, and it's about the particular theme, and I get to get up there and read people's comments about right. the theme, and sometimes
do they
comment
on the stories or what?
No, they're commenting before we hear the stories. They turn those in, and it's just they're just, you know, time killers for in between, because I pull somebody's name out of the hat and I hate for them to have to just run to the stage not knowing that they're going to be on stage. So I pull their name and they know that they're coming up. It gives them a minute or so to, you know, collect their thoughts right. and get up to the on deck circle by the stage there. And then I will read a couple of these little anonymous things that come from the audience. And sometimes they're really funny. Sometimes they're...
So people sign up.
People sign up. People drop the name in the hat.
And then you choose...
Well, you know what I normally do, and what I did this last one is I held the papers up in my hand and I asked somebody in the audience, pick a number between 1 and 5, okay. and I will just count out and I will pull that one out, and that person will be our next storyteller.
And these people have to tell stories that have all got to be true.
True
they
stories.
Can't be fables or they can't
Well, they're not
be...
supposed to be. I'm not going to fact check them. So. But, you know, the rules are true stories.
So somebody said they were eaten by an elephant, you would... sort of know that.
I would sort of know that, and they would not be eligible to win the prize at the end of the evening. The best, or I don't want to say the best storyteller, because it's not always the best storyteller that wins. It's the story that moves whoever is chosen to pick a winner. Right. We pull a name out of a hat for that as well. And
so there's one person that picks?
One person, because, you know, I don't know who's going to be there, how many people are going to be in the audience, and I could have 5 people in the audience, I could have 90 people in the audience, right. and I pull a raffle ticket out, and that person at that point says, I liked, boom, that one the best. And just for example, this last week, the story that they chose as the winner, I thought was a great story, but I thought there was somebody else whose elements of their story held with the theme much better.
So
and
is
I
it the story, it. Or is it the way they tell the story, or is it both, or what's the attraction?
The attraction is personal connection with people in the community, I think. I mean, the Petaluma West Side Stories is become really popular, and we get anywhere. I mean, it only holds, the Pelican Art Gallery only holds about 90 people safely, and we had 75 this last week.
Are they all about the individuals themselves? Do they always include themselves in the story?
I would say 90% of them do. Yeah, the most of them do. They're personal narratives. And
so what makes it not the most boring night you've ever spent listening to other people talk about themselves?
Well, here's the thing is we keep it on the theme and we keep it to 5 minutes. That's one good thing, because if a storyteller is good, 5 minutes is a nice, tight little story. And if the storyteller is not good, well, 5 minutes is all you have to wait, and then the next one will be up here. So it's not going to be – just relax, everybody. And the thing is, it's people reliving moments in their life. We've had somebody tell a story. The theme one night was water. and somebody told a story about swimming with the large sea turtles, and somebody else told a story about falling in a glacier. And somebody else told a story about this belly flop that happened to them. And somebody else told a story about being a lifeguard and having to save somebody. And so it's that personal connection. And it's people have lived these stories. And other people in the audience have a connection to this because it's true life. It's not slaying dragons. This audience has come to hear people's life experience.
Right.
And it's the audience has been cultivated over, 14 months now we've been doing it. And the audience knows what they're coming to get.
So is this a cathartic experience for these people?
I think it is for both the audience and the storyteller. We had a woman, the theme was luck, and she came up and told the story. It was about bad luck. It doesn't have to be about good luck. It's bad luck. And she told a story on Father's Day, how she was out with her father, and they went to – he was a bouncer at a bar or a bartender as well, and they ended up back at the bar where he worked. And he went to break up a bar fight, got hit in the temple – and died right there on the spot. And this, she was almost in tears when she was telling the story, and the rest of us were on the edge of our seat. And when it was all over, everybody, 75 people wanted to give this woman a hug. It was the greatest thing. It was cathartic for her, and the audience felt this empathy for her, and it was fantastic.
If you go to a show, if you go to a play, if you go to a concert or something, you get out, you might talk about it, but generally it's over, it's finished. Does it kind of tend to go on a little bit afterwards?
People stand around in there afterward and they talk about the specific stories that they just saw. Then I go to work and I'll have people.
I just thought of something.
Yeah.
I just thought of something. This isn't like an AA meeting, is it?
No, it's not. It's really because it's based on the theme. It's not people coming up there and confessing to you. It's this last time a woman told a story, and I just thought the story was just fantastic. And it was Love is Blind, and she talked about finding out that her son was autistic and how everybody around her seemed to know, but she didn't. And at the end of the story, one of the final lines was, love truly is blind, because everybody else saw that he was autistic, and all I saw was this beautiful little baby boy. And it gives me chills right now to just think about that story. And it was so good. And everybody was just riveted to her. And she told it so well. It was really well done.
So what do you hope that these people get out of it?
Audience or storytellers?
Both.
Well, I really like about the storytellers, and we have some storytellers that are regulars, and one, for example, she actually, Leslie Scatchard, went back to New York, and she went as a trip. She didn't go specifically to go to the Moth, but she said, when I'm back there, I'm going to go do it. I'm going to go to the Moth. And she dropped her name in the hat. And for the first half of the show, they do it a different way for winner. They do a scoring system. And for the first half of the show, she was in the lead. And somebody ended up taking it away from her at the end. So she came in second for the night. Now, this is a woman from Petaluma who – all of a sudden, when we started doing this storytelling thing, she told a story. And now – she is in New York on stage telling a story and almost winning the event, the Story Slam. So that, to me, was really fulfilling. I hope that people want to continue to tell stories. I hope that they just have a good time doing it. And I also hope that it really is bringing the community together. I don't think I'm going to be the mayor of Petaluma or the Pied Piper or anything like that, but I do think that every community needs a central connection, and this community is getting connected by doing this. And when times are hard, like they are right now, knowing your neighbors, which is exactly what's going on in there, is everybody's getting to know each other and supporting each other, whether they're telling a funny story or whether it's a heart-wrenching story, they're getting to know each other, and it's community support for each other. And I really hope that we can branch out. I hope to have a line standing out in front of that place that we can't accommodate those people, and we have to move to a bigger venue.
So when does West Side Stories play?
It is the second Wednesday every single month at the Pelican Art Gallery.
And what's the address?
143 Petaluma Boulevard North, and it starts at 7:30, but we take sign-ups. We open the doors at 7, and people start signing up to be storytellers at 7.
West Side Stories is a good story, and it's obviously very successful. I wish you luck with that.
I appreciate it.
Hope it expands, and I hope you can do it as much as you want, wherever you want.
I appreciate it. And by the way, it's only $5 to get in, folks. That's the whole thing. We're just trying to get the community together. So $5 is
$5?
All you're going to...
$5?
We do at least $6 worth of entertainment. I'm telling you.
Thank you, Dave Pacorni.
Thanks, John.
This is going to be Ricky. You are going to be the first one up tonight. Coming to our stage right now is a very first timer. So will you give a huge Petaluma round of applause to Ricky Freitas?
I was dreading that.
Hi there. I'm probably the youngest adult here, which is A-OK with me. So my luck is not good luck. I will start off. My name's Ricky. I'm 21. I live in Pengrove, but I'm originally from Merced, California, which is central California, middle of nowhere, agriculture, hot. You don't want to go there. But I grew up there, and my family owned a bar on and off for 30 years. And in 2002, my father was managing the bar. That weekend, we held... Actually, locally, there was a wakeboarding competition, and our bar was sponsoring it. So after the wakeboarding competition, that evening, everyone comes out, and we have food and drink and live music, and it's just like this big shindig, and it's right downtown, just like this, and lots of people showed up. And it's a bar. There are issues. So there my father is managing the bar, and there's a dispute between a woman and a Hell's Angel, from the biker group. So my father goes over and, you know, helps diffuse the situation and goes on about his business. But then, a few minutes later, he's called over. Hey, Rick, come here. So my father goes walking over to this man he's seen a couple times, being, you know, so well known and so many people that come through the bar. My family was very well known. So my father comes over, and without warning and without provocation, it takes a blow to the head. One punch this man dealt to my father here in the temple, and he was gone forever. That one punch. So luck has it that that night, Tony Aquino, a tag-along, a wannabe, decides, I'm going to prove myself tonight. I'm getting in this gang tonight. And luck has it that my father is the victim. And luck has it I never have a father again. I lose my one and only parent for the rest of my life. And I'm 13. Worst part, it's Father's Day. So to that, my luck sucks. You. Luck. You suck.
Nicely done. Nicely done. How about one big hand for Ricky right there?
We heard Dave Pacorni's West Side Stories. That was Ricky Freitas telling her own story. The next episode of West Side Stories is Wednesday, March 14th, and the topic is Carpe Diem, Seize the Day. Thanks for listening to Arts ID on KRCB Radio. We heard from playwright Rebecca Miller talking with Susan Swartz, David Templeton's true story of pursuing his first love, Pinky, and Dave Pacorni and West Side Stories. I'm your host, Robin Pressman. You can find Arts ID on our website at krcb.org.